Welcome to another episode of Breakaway from the Rat Race. And today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dog Haworth. Dog Haworth's life has been an extraordinary journey of personal challenges and groundbreaking discoveries. So when he was just 14, he became fascinated by the possibilities beyond the coordinate system of that was taught at school. And little did he know that his curiosity would intersect with a battle against a failing kidneys that lasted for over 3 decades. So this is obviously Doug came out of that. And with his newfound clarity and passion, Doug founded Hypernomics there, along with two other in his companies. He developed the world's first software capable of analyzing markets in four or more dimensions, for which they were awarded a US patent. So Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, Eric. I really like your show, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to be on. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So my pleasure. So I think it's very interesting because you kind of like related back to the basic coordinate system that we've talked about, that we've been taught in school. And then you kind of like, after this whole kidney failure ordeal, you basically came up with a completely different concept and really blew that out of the water, the basic concept of of the coordinate system.
In fact, it was 22 years ago today that I received my kidney from my best friend Tim, and it's still running like a clock. And basically what happened over 3 decades was my body filled full of poison. I couldn't figure out what was going on as clearly as I might have. And then once I got the new kidney and my blood cleared up, it enabled me to see things in new ways. So the way I came up with this idea was that I was out on a shopping trip for a new washing machine with my wife. And she said, we were striding up to this one machine. She says, the one we have at home, it's pretty small. I want something with a bigger capacity to it. So I thought capacity versus price. I said, well, that's what you call a two-dimensional problem there. Mm-hmm. She says, and at home, I've only got one delicate cycle. I understand there's machines that have more delicate cycles. I want more cycles. So then I thought cycles versus price. She's up to a 3D problem. Mm-hmm. So I like the machine we were examining, but there's, of course they have a line there. And so they had the next one up the line. And I like that one. And I said, well, honey, what about this one? It's got more of everything. She goes, it's too expensive. We can't afford it. And I realized that our little purchase was going to push the quantity sold for this unit out by one unit. Mm-hmm. And that us and everybody that was buying this was making this little dot on a coordinate system that was going out away from the axis. And it was looking at the price versus the quantity. So we were looking at, she was looking at the capacity, the cycles, the price, and collectively we're looking at the quantity. So she was solving a 4D problem in her head. Mm-hmm. And I looked around the entire store and realized that everybody in every department was solving 4D problems in their head right there, right then and there on the spot. And it turns out how people solve these ends up having, the people have collectively the same kind of idea within a range, just like we have a range of heights, mm-hmm. and a range of weights for adult humans. Well, yeah. There's a range of opinions that people have about prices. And that range is what we call self-aggregating. And we can actually figure out, based on that behavior, how people will behave relative to other things that are offered to them, and what makes things worth what people get, what they pay for it, and what makes them overpriced and what makes them underpriced. Mm-hmm. So that sent me off into basically proving this idea, which I did over numerous fields. And so we've proven that it works for everything from ground beef to train travel to spaceships. So it's pretty broad. And that's the reason that we're able to talk about it pretty confidently now after we've been working at this for a dozen years.
So what is the first field where you applied your Hypernomics concepts?
Well, I the market for electric cars was just then emerging, And I actually have a model of it here. I'm sorry, is this entirely video or audio or both?
Video and audio.
Okay, well then for your video people, I'll share with you a model of the electric car market.
All right.
And for the people that are online that are listening, I'll explain it to you in verbally. But imagine the electric car market back in 2013, and this little model that I'm holding up is a representation of that. So there's roughly 13 to 15 models in the market, and there's a couple of Teslas up here, and there's the Nissan Leaf. And so what we call the demand side, where we're plotting the quantity on the horizontal axis and the price on the vertical, there's these Teslas are pretty expensive. Only a few have sold. And down here, the Nissan Leaf was pretty cheap. And several times the amount of these sold. And so this forms what we call a demand frontier. Now, it turns out that these demand frontiers are even more important than when we first discovered them, because they apply to virtually every market that's mature. And
that
they
demand
basically...
frontier is really a representation of the price versus the quantity being sold. Is that right?
Yeah, and importantly, at the limit too. So this is what we call an upper demand frontier. Sometimes what we call an outer demand frontier forms beyond this, where it limits the total that can be sold. This is the price limitation on the market. And down here, you might have a quantity limitation on the market. And then in some markets, you might have an inner demand frontier, which says that if you're good enough to sell anything, you'll get to a certain minimum requirement. And so that describes demand. And of course, standard representation of demand is they showed you one downward sloping curve and one upward sloping supply curve. And none of the data was data free. It was just a hypothesis.
Yeah.
And they show you X marks the spot where they intersect. Well, as you can see here, all these models were doing just fine back in 2013.
Yeah.
And so instead of being in what the market would, you know, classic economists would call this equilibrium. We call this sustainable disequilibrium, meaning that as long as you're making more money than it costs you to build something, you can continue to build it. So what is it then? I had to ask myself, people were buying. So getting back to what my wife was looking at the washing machine, she was interested in capacity and cycles. Well, in an electric car back in 2013, what were people interested in? Well, along this axis, they were interested in the range. Ranges are still a massive deal for the cars. And along this axis, they were looking for horsepower. And if you take the combination of both of these things and you do a little bit of math, you get this plane that describes how people valued the range and the horsepower together. And it turns out, you see how this data, these yellow points have kind of aggregated around this plane. And so points above this plane, again, may be overpriced, or there may be some other features we left out, and points below it may be underpriced. And so this turns out to be one of the first markets we studied in depth. And
well, what's the third dimension on the left hand side?
So on the left hand side, the dimensions are range and price, and then the vertical dimension is price. And then over here, this is quantity and price. And so what's the here's you're really hitting on what's going on here. So this 2D plane abuts this 3D space. So 2 plus 3, because they share the price axis, 2 plus 3 equals 4. Excuse me. 2 plus 3 equals 4 because they share the same vertical price axis. And that's a breakthrough in thought too. And the trick to this is that the old plotting systems always had all these regions that supported negative numbers. And this dates back 400 years ago to René Descartes. So they would have, if you have any listening or watching, remember your 2D coordinate system. You had four sections there, and three sections in the 2D system would support negative numbers. And then in the 3D representation, you had these eight sections, and seven of the eight represent negative numbers. Well, what if you didn't need to have a negative region just to portray a negative condition? What do you mean by that, Doug? Well, you can have more cost than you have revenue. But in both cases, you're comparing one non-negative number to another non-negative number. So you don't need to have a negative region. And so the way we help people imagine this is, imagine this looks a little bit, again, listeners who are, trying to imagine this, is on the right hand or demand side, it kind of looks like a wall.
Yeah.
And so this might be the back wall of a two-room house. Imagine a rectangular house of two square rooms. And so on the right-hand wall in the back, you got these points that are vertically represent the price and horizontally represent the quantity.
Mm-hmm.
Over in the left-hand room, you've got these two value attributes, which here are, range and horsepower, but you've got those points suspended in space and you've got this plane going through it. And so this house doesn't look unlike, if listeners were interested in doing this, they could go look up the birthhouse of Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
So we like to talk about the house of Elvis. So the house of Elvis was a two-room shotgun shack, as they say in the South, that was basically one rectangular house with two square rooms in it. And so in that house, you've got one set of points on one side and the other on the other, and they are actually connected by these opposing forces.
Yeah.
And so we take this house of Elvis, and instead of going in Tupelo, Mississippi, we might put the origin where the back wall and the floor intersect at the South Pole. Imagine the South Pole going up through the middle of these two rooms. And then instead of calling the South Pole 90 degrees south, we call that zero.
Yeah.
And then you can imagine everything going away from the South Pole. Goes out in positive directions. So if you go into Argentina and Australia, by the way, share a border, a one-point border, or I should say a one-line border, if you go up into the airspace, where is the South Pole, and Argentina and Australia both have this common territory that's common to, whether it's in Antarctica, that has this common point where they end, like kind of like a pie slice. And so if you take one step into Australia, the Australian territory, you're in positive Australia space, but you're not in negative Argentina space. And if you were to walk back to the South Pole and go the other direction, you're not going into the negative direction from the place you just left. And that turns out, as simple as it is, that's basically key to being able to come up with a coordinate system that's infinitely expandable. You can expand this to as many coordinates as you care to by compressing the data.
Yeah,
and just making it
all. So you have your Tesla model there. So how would the Tesla model that you showed there in Hypernomics model, how does that help me make a decision about Tesla, either about buying Tesla or about buying the Tesla shares? Or how does that help me? How do I use this and then say, oh, I should buy at this price, I should sell at this price?
Yeah, interestingly, we have the software will take all the features of the cars. You have to go out and actually create a database of cars. And we may eventually automate that so we have databases that people could just use. But you take the Tesla electric cars, the BMWs, the Mercedes, you know, the Fords, everybody else, you put them into this data set, and you'd figure out that right now what you're buying, because now there's different sizes of these electric cars compared to 2013. Back then, they were all two and four seaters.
Yeah.
Well, now you can get two seaters, four seaters, all the way up to seven seats, maybe even eight. So you have the seats on one axis and the horsepower on another. And by those two variables, they describe a lot of the value. But then back to your point, the thing that's neat about Tesla is that they are very safe. And so we've done some studies separately in a different industry that shows that, what, aerospace, as it happens, where we're seeing that Boeing is taking it on the chin because their safety is starting to fall off the off the wagon.
Yeah.
Well, before all they had problems with the safety at Boeing, we did a study that looked at the value of airliners. And Boeing and Airbus have, you know, basically their A320 and their, you know, Boeing 737 Max that they're coming out with now. They both look a lot like a Tupolev 204, which is made in Russia. But Boeing has sold 7,000, you know, Boeing 737s of the 700, 800, 900 series. And Tupolev sold about 1/100th of that. And Tupolev sells for a cheaper price and goes faster and has longer range. Well, what's going on? Well, the safety of the Boeing and the Airbus planes is approximately 10 to 20 times what it is for the Tupolev. Now, the Tupolev is a very safe plane, much safer than walking or driving or anything else, but the Boeing and Airbus planes are 20 times safer. And so it turns out if you're 10 times safer, you get 50% more return that roughly from that. And so part of what you're buying when you're buying a Tesla is you're buying that added safety on top of everything else. And so what you would do if you're buying the car, you'd mix all that stuff together and see if the Tesla is on the price that makes the right price for you, or if it's a little overpriced or underpriced. And then you might compare it to other cars that you're interested in and see which one has the best value for you.
But there are a lot of different features. I mean, there's probably thousands of features that you when you compare like the Boeing with the Tupolev, or if you're gonna compare like Tesla with what's the Toyota? I forget what the name is called, but Toyota and the Nissan Leaf.
Yes, right.
Right. So how do you like? You have to narrow down the features, or you have to score the features, or how do you do that?
Well, we don't actually score the features. What it turns out is the market scores the features. And so what we discover is that if you were to pick up, say, the horsepower and the number of seats, that that would explain something on the order of 90% of the variation of the data
on
two features.
Okay. So when you look at the demand side of things, you say, well, on the demand side, the factors or the variables that are explaining the variation between the choices is going to be, maybe it's like four or five different variables. It could be safety, it could be the range, it could be whatever. And that's what
we're using those value variables on what we call the left hand or the green side typically to figure that out. And then what is it applies to demand. If the price is high, they're going to move up the demand curve. But if they get too expensive, if they get beyond what the demand curve can support, a company could go bankrupt. So on my LinkedIn site back in December of 2020, after following the supersonic business jet company for a number of years that was called Aireon, A-E-R-I-O-N. Aireon was building this plane called the Aireon AS2. And when they launched in 2014, they had 20 orders. But they claimed they were going to sell 300 of these guys in a decade and 500 overall. And at the end of 5 years, they still had the same 20 orders. And I did a plot that figured out back on this demand side here, that figured out what the limit was. Well, it turned out this demand curve was moving in their favor. So when they started out, by my calculation, the market would have supported 47. Recall they had 20. And 5 years later, it would have supported 63. Moving in their direction, they want to sell a lot. That's good. But recall they wanted to sell, you know, in 10 years, they wanted to sell about five times that amount. And so I worked it out that the chance of them selling what they wanted to sell at the price they were charging, and by the way, their price, using our analytics, their price checked out, it was worth every penny that they were charging. But there weren't enough pennies in the world to sell 300 of these things. And that's what I wrote. Worth every penny, not enough pennies. And so I had, that was my headline. And I explained what was going on. And then I got an angry reply from a guy at Aireon who said, well, a couple of days later, after something came in, he said, oh, we just got this big order and you're all wet. Well, he didn't explain that or elaborate that the order was all options, which means in aerospace speak that if it works and it flies and everybody else likes it and gets certified, then I'll buy it. That's not a, what they call a firm commitment. Anyway, I said, well, you know, I wrote back. I said, well, good for you. You're still not anywhere close to your target. You're going to fail, but good luck. And 6 months later, they went bankrupt.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, you know, I didn't wish him ill. I just pointed out that that was going to happen.
We're down the stock market?
What's that?
But they're in the stock market or?
No. This was entirely for a business jet that they were trying to build.
All right. So let's talk about, so a lot of my listeners are, you know, they're really interested in real estate. And, you know, for me, especially, I'm interested in single family rentals. So how does that work? Like, how do I use, let's say I read your books. Your book is coming out. Okay. Hyperonomics is coming out in a couple of weeks. I read your book and I say, oh my, I install or buy your software. I'm not sure how that works, but how do I get started? What's the first thing that I need to do in order to kind of start using or actually walk towards like a better understanding of the market using Hypernomics?
Well, we have some real estate examples that we'll share with people. That'll be part of what we'll provide when we sell the software. But what we've done in a previous class is we've given a list of houses in here in the United States, might be in Stratford, Connecticut, which is a coastal town in on the East Coast. And then we might show Montecito, California, a very high-end coastal town here in Southern California. And then we'll ask people to, we might separate the groups to say, well, what do you think, what do you suppose supports the price of a house? And here's where your intuition comes in. You'd say, well, I bet square footage has something to do with it. And if you apply square footage, you'd be right. You'd get a very good answer that says square footage explains something like 60 to 70% of the variation off of the average. And you might say, well, I bet the...
You're kind of using correlation? You're using some kind
of... Yeah, we're doing correlations, exactly. Yeah. And then you might say, well, I bet the lot size has something to do with it. You do lot size. Hey, that does, works too. And then you might say, well, I bet a brand new house is worth more than one that's 50 years old. And it turns out most cases it is. And so you could add that back in. You can keep adding these. What you basically are doing here, Eric, is you're applying your intuition or your knowledge to the market. And what you what you figure out is you're starting to reduce your error terms from being pretty wide at the beginning. As you keep adding these features, you're narrowing down your errors to the point where, hey, I'm starting to feel pretty comfortable with the answers that I've got here. And so you might take a couple of cuts at the data. And suppose you're trying to buy a house that you believe is undervalued. We might do several cuts of this and kind of change some of the independent variables around, you know, like the square footage and the number of bathrooms and number of bedrooms. You might swap those around because they explain the same thing. You want to maybe vary that. And then you might see that the same house, you might create like five or six estimates. And you might see the same two or three houses appear on every one of your estimates. And you might say, well, between these two houses, they both look like they're undervalued. I'm going to pick the one that's best out of these. And that's kind of how we, well, it's almost exactly how we do the analysis for the stock market. So we've been picking stocks using this technique now for 47 months. We're just short of our 4-year anniversary. And so as of last week, we're 1.7x better than the S&P 500, only drawing stocks from that pool, and about 1.2 times as well as the Berkshire Hathaway people. So there's basically what you do is you start out by using your intuition and your knowledge, and then you start to add in other things that might be important. And then sometimes somebody might point out something to you that you hadn't considered. So, you know, circling back to aerospace, which is what we know, it's where I came from. We were doing an analysis of a plane for a general aviation manufacturer. And, you know, we took the basic features, much like the car. How many seats does it have? Okay, great. How much horsepower does it have? Cool. How far can it go? Range, you know. And then these guys said to us, you know, we think our plane is prettier than the average plane. Could you quantify the value of it being maybe better looking than the other planes? And we said, I don't know. It's a fabulous question. And what you'll find is when you start talking to people that are in your group, you're going to get a lot of people come up with fabulous questions that you hadn't entertained. So we decided to entertain that question. We took all the planes for which we had the information that were part of this database, and we managed to get what they call three views of the plane. So you're seeing it from the front, from the side, and from the top, front, side, and top. We sent these three views without their names out to a bunch of respondents. Well, we should have more respondents to be statistically significant, but sometimes you have to take what you have. And we went out and sent it out to these people. And it turned out that there were planes that they liked better than other planes relative to their value. And it turned out that the plane that our client was trying to tout was very close to the top. And so they would receive a benefit for making a more widely accepted style for the market taste than some of the other planes that were less stylish for the market. And so there, it turns out that there's a whole plethora of ideas that you can throw at the topic to try to neck the variation down.
Yeah, and then you would know. So it could be anything. So yeah, the good looking idea, and you know, if it doesn't correlate, if the correlation is not significant, or you can say, well, you know, that doesn't matter. Then
right.
I can erase that from the model, basically.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Okay. So yeah. So you basically, one brute force scenario would be to throw all the factors at it and see what sticks, kind of thing, right?
Yeah, you could do that. Often what happens in a situation like that is that, you know, let's go back to houses. Some factors explain the same thing. So if I'm looking at a house and I want to explain its value, I'm going to use square footage. But the square footage is made up of rooms, and the rooms, you're going to be counting the number of bedrooms and the number of bathrooms.
Yeah.
And so what you might do is you might have a time where you work out the price of the house based on the square footage, but then you might say, I'm going to do it based on the number of bedrooms. Now, you might be tempted to do bedrooms and square footage, but what you might find is that they're what they call in the industry cross-correlated, which means that they each explain the same thing.
Yeah.
So you separate out the things that explain the same thing, but you test them separately so that you have multiple cuts.
Yeah.
And what it is that you're doing. And so you can take something that would seemingly be a hassle for you, which is having to have separate out the variables that explain the same thing, but then separate them out and create different scenarios.
Yeah.
And then see what comes up out of the data. And that's the way we proceed on a lot of our stuff. But yeah, you take a company like Renaissance Technologies that's got, they basically have the world's most lucrative hedge fund in the world. And what they've done is they've yanked in a bunch of PhDs and people from a variety of fields to analyze markets. And they're pulling in, you know, petabytes of data. And they're looking, as you said, they're looking at everything.
Yeah.
And then they'll use some artificial intelligence to work out some of these relationships. So now, like what we like to say with our stuff, when you start to be able to work with these multiple dimensions, we're going to have a little bit less A, artificial,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit more I, more intelligence. So less A, more I, because we want to be able to see what it is that's coming out of an AI environment. AI, as they like to say, is kind of a black box. So we try to remove that part of the equation by visualizing what we can visualize.
You can get some insight into the market dynamics as opposed to,
right.
Yeah, because AI is just like a black box, a massive matrix of numbers you don't, and you can't decipher it back.
Yeah, and so so for example, one of the things I did April of 2023, I published a paper that it sounds convoluted. It sounds like it's right out of Buckaroo Banzai. I don't know if you or your fans know the movie Buckaroo Banzai, his adventures across the eighth dimension.
No,
Buckaroo Banzai was a race car driver, brain surgeon, and rock star. And so in the movie, he drives through a mountain and runs into the eighth dimension. And I always thought that was kind of cute. And I always took that kind of as a personal challenge once I figured out some of this stuff, if I could write a paper that had eight dimensions in it.
Yeah.
And so last April, I wrote a paper entitled 8D Cost Trades with Entanglement, in which I used a 1-4D model, like I showed you there.
Entanglement?
I used a four-dimensional model of the business aircraft market because I've been studying that.
Yeah.
And then I used another 4D model of the engines that go into them.
Yeah.
So they're turbojet, they're turbofan engines. So you take one 4D model and another 4D model, and because they share the price axis, in this case, 4 + 4 = 7, because the price axis can't be double counted. And so I discovered that the Boeing business jet, by my accounting, was up against its demand frontier, and so was one of its engines. And so using the eighth dimension, which would be time, we suggested that if they both were to drop their prices, because the engine's about a quarter to anywhere from a fifth to half of the cost of a plane,
Wow.
If the engine manufacturer and the airframer both dropped their prices, they could make more money. And they also showed it for that company that I was telling you about that was making the supersonic business jet.
Yeah.
They had this Frontier, and that was the Frontier moved. It was moving in their direction, but not by as much as they needed it to move. And so we used the eight dimensions there, and it turned out to be pretty useful stuff.
Yeah. So for back on the real estate front, so I basically get a whole bunch of properties, and then I can look at all these properties here, and I look at the square footage, I look at this, and kind of like the average, and I would be able to compare. It would help me find markets that I would be interested in working with potentially, right?
Yes, and then when you're talking about refinements, a refinement we found for especially city dwellers or commercial real estate is there's something here in LA called Walk Score. Have you ever run into the thing? So you're familiar. Okay, well, Walk Score, for your listeners that maybe haven't heard about this, Walk Score tries to explain how easy it is for you walking to get to the various services that you need, the barber, the beauty salon, the
Grocery.
dry cleaners, the grocery store, gas, et cetera, et cetera. And so here in LA, just for a test, just to see how this would work, we took two cuts at a piece of property, or properties, I should say, in Los Angeles County that were in the same zip code, and that would have, say, a certain number of square footage. So we got all these properties, put them all in the same zip code, worked out the value of the properties as a function of their square footage and their walk score. And it turned out that properties that had walk scores of 90, 100s being best, were more worth more than twice as much as properties that had a 45 for a walk score.
Yeah.
Now, as they say, your results will vary town to town, zip code to zip code. But that is something that, I mean, I didn't know very much about property values until I got into it. But somebody suggested that we take a look at that.
Yeah.
Again, you're paying attention to people that know a lot about your field, and you'll find that a whole bunch of people can contribute very deeply to what it is that you're doing. And so that's the great thing about this is that it really lends itself to group interactions and people tossing ideas towards the solution. And as you start to throw different things into this, you can come up with some pretty good solutions. And that's kind of what we're trying to do.
One of our challenges when we're buying single family to rent and to renovate, so we buy distressed properties. So we buy single family rentals that are distressed, and then we renovate them, rent them out, and resell them. That's the
Sure.
big, and that's what our students at Flip System do also. So I have a bunch of properties, let's say in a market. So I've selected a market, and I want to say, okay, well, I want to buy, tell me which properties I should buy, which single family rentals I should buy. I'm looking for distressed, so obviously someone has to look at pictures to show
Sure.
that this property is distressed. And then you would look at the numbers, and then you would be able to say, calculate based on that bit on the information you would see, you would be able to extrapolate what we call the after repair value of that property would be.
Yes,
And then
precisely.
okay.
Yeah. In fact, if it's if you're building it back, say it was a teardown, you could work out, you would reset it to the value as new. And it turns out that the newness in houses is more important than you might imagine. The newness means that basically you've got a whole bunch of systems that won't crack. So I'm sitting in or here in a house that was built in 1996, and the hot water heater goes, the heating system goes, the air conditioner goes, and on and on and on. But that goes on over the course of many years because the house isn't brand new. You get a brand new house, well, it's kind of like getting a brand new car. I mean, the house comes under a warranty, and you a whole bunch of things that you might have to sweat out in a distressed property. Now that you've made it non-distressed, you don't sweat that anymore. And that improves the value, as you know, but you can actually quantify that. And that's what we like to try to be able to do.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Well, very interesting. Very interesting. So you wrote a book, Doug, Hypernomics, that's coming out in the next couple of weeks. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, it's coming out next Tuesday. Here it is. Hypernomics, for those of you here on YouTube, this is the book. It's entitled Hypernomics, Using Hidden Dimensions to Solve Unseen Problems. And while it may sound complicated, I mean, I guess, again, I got the idea of watching my wife, a school teacher, elementary school teacher.
Well, she was solving these problems in her head, so it can't be that.
She was solving that problem in her head. She was smarter than I was. And the point is that everybody's doing this all the time. So what it's really doing is it's taking something that you already know and rearranging it into something you haven't seen before, but you probably want to know. And that's how we try to describe it to people, is that it takes a whole bunch of information that you've got a good handle on already, but then it rearranges it in a way that you can act upon it. And that's what's exciting about it for us.
Okay. No, so that sounds very interesting. Where can they get the book if they're interested in?
Well, right now it's already available for pre-sale on the Wiley site and also on Amazon.
Okay.
And Barnes & Noble. And it should be in Barnes & Noble next week. So some of them at least. So
excellent. Well, congratulations on the publication
Thank
of
you.
Your book. That's phenomenal. I hope I'm going to grab a copy, see what this is all about, get into details.
Oh, yeah. Well, I appreciate that, Eric. And, you know, hopefully I can see you someday and put my signature in the book for you there. So that'd be
absolutely
great.
That sounds good. Sounds pretty good. So, Doug, if people want to reach out to you, and you mentioned also the software and all that kind of stuff. So where can they reach out? Where can they get the software? I mean, you probably mentioned it in the book also, but how can they reach out to you if they're interested?
Well, we have our company website. So it's Hypernomics. That's Hypernomics, hypernomics.com is the website, and we have the software for sale there. We're also going to be giving classes in this. I will have a free seminar, I think, next week or the week after on this. That's my goal right now. The software, once you know what to do with it, it's pretty intuitive, but the theory, we're going to suggest people get the classes, because the theory is something that's, well, basically the world hadn't seen it before, and it becomes, it's something that, you know, you could, if you read the book, you can probably figure it out. But, you know, why figure it out from scratch when somebody can walk you through it? And that's kind of what the class will do for you. And then I have my personal website, which is Doug Howarth. So it's DougHowarth, DougHowarth.com. And the book will be on sale through there too. And there'll probably be links back to the software. Actually, I don't think we have that in there yet, but we need to do that.
Well,
and that's what's going on right now for the book.
Sounds good. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
I think that free webinar seminar is going to be very, very important to really have people really wrap their head around it, even though you mentioned that it's something that people are doing already in their head and stuff. This is kind of like formalizing a proper methodology or a process for handling all these kinds of problems and then finding the right solution.
That's a very good way to put it there, Eric. It's exactly what we're doing. Thank you. Yes.
Great. So
great.
Thank you, Doug. It was a pleasure speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Eric. I really enjoyed myself here. Thanks. You asked all the right questions. I had a great time. Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Break Away from the Rat Race with your host, Eric Martel. If you want to share your story and experience with our listeners, please message us on Facebook at Break Away from the Rat Race. Also, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and our podcast on iTunes.